Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In that war, economic warfare is an increasingly important battle space, and few people understand it better or have been more effectively engaged in addressing it than our first guest. He is Kevin Freeman. He is the proprietor of an extraordinary television program that Blaze TV called Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. He is also the author of two terrific books, Game Plan and Secret Weapon, and a man who contributes mightily to the public policy debate, notably through his appearances here on this program and as a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy. Always delighted to have him. Welcome back, Kevin.
Thank you, Frank. Always good to be with you.
I know you have been involved in an important initiative that we talked a bit about last week with several of our guests, and I'd like to get your take on it as well, Kevin. What is happening with this so-called woke capital, particularly in the context most immediately of another area of interest of yours, election integrity, and the attacks that a lot of corporations are now mounting against Georgia for the enactment of legislation intended to improve election integrity there? What's going on, and how significant is this development, and what can we do about it?
Well, what's going on is the progressive left has weaponized big business. They have struck behind-the-scenes deals, apparently, with all of these large American businesses, whether it's Coca-Cola or the Major League Baseball or Delta Airlines, to get them to interfere in the affairs of the local government, whether it's the Georgia State Legislature or any local government. Literally, they're using business as an economic weapon to hammer people to force them into progressive direction. And in the case of Georgia, in particular, they're telling the state, you can't have an ID. You can't require an ID to be seen if you're going to have an absentee ballot, which is ludicrous. If you don't have the ID provision, it opens up to all kinds of voter fraud. And these same companies require IDs for almost everything that they do. And so it is hypocritical, and it is a weapon aimed at the American people by big business.
The impact of which, in terms of legislation, in terms of these states that are wrestling with this very serious problem, is a microcosm of a bigger problem, is it not? It seems today as though this weaponization of big business is a blunt instrument to bludgeon politicians and businesses that aren't woke and the American people, more or less, into submission to the radical left's agenda writ large. Is that how you see it? And talk a little bit about this new initiative that you're associated with, this StopCorporateTyranny.org, as a resource for finding out more about all of this.
Well, absolutely, it's something more insidious. It's a corporatocracy. It is big business and big government blending together to control what we think, how we act, what we're able to buy and sell. I mean, it includes Facebook and Twitter canceling people who say opinions that disagree with the opinions that the leadership of Facebook and Twitter hold. And it's not going to end well. We're going to see a complete control mechanism laid down on the American people to where you really don't have a say in government. Your voice doesn't count. What counts is what the big business leaders and the politicians and bureaucrats want to see happen. And so we're standing up, as you mentioned, StopCorporateTyranny.org. In the end, a majority of the American people don't want woke Coke. They want a Coke and a smile. They don't want Coca-Cola telling them how to think, what to do, how to act. Remember, Coke was the one that was going to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. Well, apparently they've decided to ignore their customers and to try and cram something down. So we're standing up with StopCorporateTyranny.org. It's a place, it's a coalition where like-minded people can go, and in 60 seconds you can point, click, act, and you can send a message to the leadership at Coke, plus the message of the politicians. We're not going to accept this. This is not right. We don't want Facebook and Twitter telling us how to think and act. We don't want Coke telling us how to think and act. We want America to be we the people, under the sovereign of the people, not big business and not big government.
Yeah. Speaking of the freedom of speech, I was heartened to see Justice Clarence Thomas weighing in on this idea of the big tech companies being able to essentially impose limitations on freedom of speech by virtue of having the protections of the so-called Section 230. This is a straw in the wind, I hope, for corrections that are going to be coming in that domain. Kevin Freeman. But let me turn to another topic that I know you're very focused on as well, and that is the prospect that we're looking at a degree of inflation taking place even now, let alone what may be coming our way, as we see the Congress of the United States and the Biden administration essentially driving the value of the dollar ever downward. Talk a little bit about all of this, Kevin, and the fact that this Senate parliamentarian has just ruled that the administration can continue to get its way through the United States Senate through this technique known as budget reconciliation, even if they have no Republican support for such legislation as this $2.3 trillion infrastructure bill.
Well, let's just take it to its logical end. If $2.3 trillion infrastructure bill passes and we have a $28.2 trillion national debt, we're looking at $30.5 trillion worth of debt. We're looking at a bigger government. What we're facing then is President Biden's already said we should raise corporate taxes. And people say, well, then people will move their corporations out of the country. And then he said, then we should raise global taxes. We should make sure every country raises corporate taxes. What we're looking at is a big government takeover. It's the same story as we had. Yes, it's going to put us, enslave us economically. When you have $30.5 trillion worth of debt right now, the amount debt per citizen is approaching $100,000 per citizen and about $250,000 per taxpayer. That's what we're facing, and we're adding to that. So the reality is you're going to be taxed forever and at higher and higher rates. That will slow the economy. It will put us in a much worse position than we're in, and it will bring that nasty bug of inflation back in a vengeful way to where, you think, well, I'm getting $15 an hour with the new minimum wage, which is what they're trying to force upon us, and you get $15 an hour minimum wage, it won't come anywhere close to providing a living wage, which means it'll be an ever increasing minimum wage requirement. And what it does is it just enslaves the people to big government and big business. And it's the same story.
And if we have the dollar replaced as the reserve currency of the world, things get infinitely worse, a topic to which we will return with you next week. Kevin Freeman, thanks for your time this week and for the great work you do at economicwarroom.com. Please check it out, folks. Talk to you soon. Thanks, Kevin. Next up, we will speak with John Rossomondo about the coming threat of Chinese military action against Taiwan and what we had best be doing about it right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, and it's a pleasure to say a welcome to John Rossomondo, a colleague of mine at the Center for Security Policy, which he works to help us understand and contribute to the public policy debate about national security, specifically our defense capabilities and the challenges to them and what we need to do about all of that. John brings to this a great background in investigative journalism, a prize-winning one at that, as well as his considerable accomplishments in the business of counterterrorism reporting with our friend Steve Emerson at the Investigative Project on Terrorism. We're delighted to have him back. John, as always, good to have you, sir.
Thanks a lot, Frank. I appreciate being back with you.
I need to talk to you, John, about a piece that you had at the National Interest the other day, in which you warned about what now is seemingly the increasing public narrative of American military personnel and leaders specifically about the adequacy of our military to contend with the threat that is now increasingly ominous from communist China to Taiwan. What are these admirals and generals saying, and what are the implications of it?
Now, I think that we're seeing that the Chinese are becoming more and more brazen. I mean, right now, the Chinese strategy is what they call in parlance, A2AD, to deny us access to the seas off of Taiwan. The Chinese just sent a carrier battle group through the straits in those southern Japanese islands. I think that was a warning to the Japanese that, if you do anything to defend Taiwan, we're coming after you. I mean, I think that the United States and Japan and Australia need to develop our own denial strategy aimed at developing longer range anti-aircraft missiles, like Japan's island of Yonaguni, which is located about 120 miles east of Taiwan, would be a perfect unsinkable aircraft carrier because we could put anti-ship and develop a longer range anti-aircraft missile to knock down the Chinese bombers and to keep the fleet from operating on the eastern side of Taiwan, which is sort of the soft underbelly of the beast, which would be the Chinese strategy.
John, let me go back for just a minute before we get to what we need to do about it, to talk a little bit about, in addition to this carrier battle group, and we'll talk a little bit more in all of this regard with Gordon Chang in a moment, but what you're seeing, what our military are seeing with these exercises, these flights of aircraft, as well as naval force movements, seems to be, as best I can tell, preparations for a very short notice, if any, invasion of the island. Is that what you're hearing from your military conduct?
That's what I'm hearing. That's what I'm seeing. How many times have we seen it in the past where you had military exercises that turned into an invasion? It's kind of like, you stun your prey, and then you go in and kill it. That's sort of what I'm seeing. I mean, the constant flights are to challenge the Taiwanese so they don't know when the real thing is coming. And when we don't know when the real thing is coming, and by the time, so we need to have a strategy to where they're on day zero. You know, when I had the former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Sandy Gwynnefeld, on my Senator webinar, he said we need to have our assets in place now.
And when he's talking about assets, John, what kinds of assets are we talking about? You mentioned, long-range air defenses, for example. Our own carrier battle group, the Teddy Roosevelt, is now in the South China Sea, apparently. And, we have some capacity to surge forces there. The challenge for us, as I see it, is presence. And one of the things that's so troubling, we'll again talk about this with Gordon, about these permanent bastions that the Chinese have been building in the South China Sea, is their presence is continuous. Ours is, fleeting, in a manner of speaking. How does that fit into these strategic calculations, do you think?
Well, I think the fact that we don't have anything that's immediately there is allowing the vastly growing Chinese Navy and Air Force to fill in a vacuum. I mean, it's like we have bases in Okinawa, we have bases in Guam, but, they're like about a day away. I mean, we need to have, have additional bases, whether it's like in the northern Philippines or further down the Japanese island chain, so that we can command presence immediately. I mean, we probably would need, in my opinion, to have forward basing for our submarines, so that, they can act and to deter the Chinese Navy. I mean, of course, the west side of the Taiwan Straits is not exactly perfect for submarine warfare because it's so shallow. But, you know, we need to be able to put maybe F-35s or other assets that can react in a moment's notice to, you know, remind the Chinese that we're there, and we need to work on ramping it up. But unfortunately, I don't think the Biden administration is in the game.
That's a key question. And Gordon, I know shares our feeling, John, that the Chinese Communist Party has dealt for years with the Biden team, as you call it, and whether they have actually compromise them in various ways, or whether they simply know and discount their resolve, specifically with respect to the South China Sea, starting with Joe Biden himself, going back to 2012 when this atoll fortification exercise began. I think they have discounted the possibility that there will be much pushback from Washington to any of this kind of behavior. And John, I guess one question that occurs to me, it's an audacious idea to be sure, but putting American forces on Taiwan itself may be the thing that would be the ultimate deterrent to attack. On the other hand, it also might be the catalyst for an attack. I don't know. What do you make of that idea, and is it being discussed anywhere in Washington, as best you can tell?
It's being mentioned like in academic journals and things like the proceedings of the U.S. Naval Institute. They had suggested just giving the Taiwanese the recently decommissioned U.S. Marine Corps tanks. I mean, the Marines just decided last fall to divest themselves of heavy armor for the first time in almost a century. And the other thing we could consider would be to sending mercenaries. That's another idea. I don't think there's the political stomach in Washington to put troops on Taiwan.
So it still is the case of trying to equip the Taiwanese and providing them with a large number of tanks that are now excess to our needs, we're told, may be just such a step. But again, the question is, have we allowed the Chinese to become so emboldened by our inaction to date that they may feel as though they can act quickly with impunity against Taiwan? John, when you talk to people like Admiral Winfield, are they sanguine that we have the kind of equipment that we need now to contend with the Chinese if they're in position? Or are we also grievously short in terms of capabilities in our inventory? The thing that comes to mind is you mentioned advanced F-35s. The Chinese have, for example, been pursuing, we're told, through their emphasis on artificial intelligence and quantum computing and big data and so on, the newer applications of those sorts of technologies to autonomous weapon systems, whether on the oceans, undersea, or in the air. Where do we stand in the United States military in those regards? And would those be the kinds of capabilities that we should be putting into place out in that region as quickly as possible? And are we doing so?
From the looks of it, I don't think we have the right mix of resources. I mean, our military is largely old. We've expended trillions, in these guerrilla wars in Central Asia and in Iraq, et cetera. And, the Chinese have everything is brand spanking new for them. I mean, we have the Joint Artificial Intelligence Center at the Pentagon, but I don't think that, we're really looking forward in terms of our capabilities the way that the Chinese are. I think that we're, really falling behind. I mean, we can't even, maintain our, Ticonderoga class cruisers to the necessary specifications, let alone be able to counter China and provide enough of a pushback that they would think twice about invading Taiwan.
Well, what comes to mind is Donald Trump's old adage that you go to war with the army you have. In this case, it may be the Navy we have, but it certainly behooves us to ensure that that Navy is as fit as it can be and forward deployed as much as it can be to try to deter this potential for aggression in the South China Sea and general in Taiwan Strait in particular. Thank you, John, for your time today, as well as the work you do at the Center for Security Policy. I know you'll keep it up. Come back to us with further reporting soon, if you would. Next up, we will speak, as promised, with Gordon Chang, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by the great Gordon Chang. He is one of our country's preeminent experts on matters involving, well, our interest in Asia and what they might mean for us if things go seriously wrong. He is the author of numerous books, including The Coming Collapse of China. You see him in all of the right places, including Fox News. We're very pleased to have him as a regular here, and to follow him at Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Let's start with some of the things that we were hearing from John Rossomondo a moment ago, Gordon, about the increasing signs, well, for that matter, the explicit testimony of American military leaders that we are seriously challenged, shall we say, when it comes to our ability to defend or help in the defense of Taiwan, should the Chinese Communist Party decide to act on its long-stated ambition to, secure that island's, shall we say, participation in the People's Republic of China going forward. What is your current reading on both the danger that China is poised to act on that aspiration and how they're reading these kinds of signals out of Washington and elsewhere?
Well, the comments from our military about China ready to attack are mirrored by what people in Beijing are saying. There are a number of voices there who say that Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, must annex Taiwan within a five-year time frame. And I think that's what's causing concern among our military and among militaries around the world. There are just these voices that have made it clear that they are preparing to act. And this is mirrored by the almost daily incursions of Chinese aircraft into the Taiwan's air defense identification zone. And we have recently seen the movement of China's first aircraft carrier, the Liaoning, with its support ships going through the Mayoko Straits. And they probably are going to circle around Taiwan. This is an increasingly dangerous situation, Frank.
And would you say, Gordon, that the Chinese Communist Party is reading correctly the attitude of the Biden administration, that it won't be able to or have the will to respond should China act in this manner?
I don't know. I don't know what the Biden administration will do. The Biden administration has done...
No, it's less a question of what they will do, Gordon, than how they're being perceived by Beijing, I guess, that I'm interested in.
Yeah, Beijing actually thinks it owns the Biden administration. And we know this from what we have heard from voices there. They talk about Hunter Biden. They talk about the Wall Street connection. So they believe that they can do whatever they want. Now, that's not to say that they're right, but that is to say that's their mentality. And because of that, they are emboldened to do things which could trigger conflict.
Yes, I'm afraid so, too. In part, this is because of past experience with Joe Biden as well. And you've written recently, Gordon, I believe at Gatestone Institute, about the past experience and the present crisis, really, that is now upon us with respect to the South China Sea. Talk a little bit about what Joe Biden did back in 2012 when he had the portfolio for addressing what China was doing, building these bastion islands on uninhabited atolls in the South China Sea, and what is happening today at a place called Whitsun Reef.
Well, Whitsun Reef is about 170, 180 nautical miles from the Philippines. It's within the Philippines' exclusive economic zone. It's very far away from China, but we've seen, especially since the first week of March, about 220 Chinese fishing trawlers and other vessels in tight formation around Whitsun, preventing Philippine fishermen from going there. And this is reminiscent of what happened in early 2012 around Scarborough Shoal, which is even closer to the Philippines than Whitsun is. Scarborough was important because it guards the mouths to both Manila and Subic Bays. And in early that year, we saw both Chinese and Philippine vessels crowd around that feature to prevent a confrontation. The Obama administration actually brokered a deal between Manila and Beijing for both sides to withdraw their craft. Only the Philippines complied, leaving China in control of Scarborough. The administration did not enforce the agreement it brokered, and China's then did something which is important, because we talk about the fortification of those islands in the Spratlys that occurred just months after the failure of the Obama administration at Scarborough. China then ramped up pressure on other Philippine features in the South China Sea, and then China then started to go after the Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea, which both Japan and China claim, but which Japan is in control of. So really what China did was it made the problem bigger, because the Obama administration, by refusing to enforce the deal that it put together, just emboldened the worst elements in the Chinese political system by showing everybody that aggression in fact worked. We're seeing the same series of events play out at Whitsun. We don't know what the Biden team will do, but this is exceedingly dangerous because, as you point out, Frank, it's the mentality of the Chinese rulers that is really the critical issue here.
Unfortunately, the Biden team today, starting with, of course, the commander-in-chief, is pretty much the Biden team that was in place back in 2012, was it not? And doesn't that really further exacerbate the problem you talked about a moment ago, Gordon, which is that the Chinese think they own this administration? And whether it's a misperception or whether it's a correct assessment, they seem to think they can have their way with us. And that's a very dangerous development. And talk about why, Gordon, it's dangerous. These places seem very far removed. I suspect most Americans couldn't find them on a map. But what are the implications for us if these claims and actual seizing of areas of the South China Sea, to say nothing of Taiwan, actually were to eventuate, as you suggest they may?
Well, right now at this moment, Frank, we are seeing, as I mentioned, the Chinese sortie that carrier group of theirs. Also at the same time, the Mustin, which is an Arleigh Burke destroyer, is sailing off the coast of Shanghai. And the Theodore Roosevelt carrier strike group just entered the South China Sea through the Malacca Straits. So we're seeing a lot of naval forces enter into generally the same area. This is exceedingly dangerous when that occurs, because that is an essential element of conflict. And to answer your earlier point, it was Kurt Campbell, then at the State Department, who was the one in the Obama administration who negotiated that deal between Manila and Beijing over Scarborough. And now in the Biden administration, it is Kurt Campbell who is the Asia czar. So we're seeing many of the same faces from the Obama national security team in the Biden one.
Yeah, and Blinken and Sullivan and on and on. It's ominous. And I guess the point I was trying to get at, Gordon, is if the South China Sea actually falls under Chinese control, if Taiwan actually is annexed by China, the repercussions are going to be very far-reaching, economically, commercially, as well as in terms of geopolitical development. No?
It could very well be the end of America's role in the world, not just in Asia, because countries not only in the region, but in Europe and all other places are looking at this as a question of American resolve, whether we can defend the global commons. Remember, our notion is that there's international waters, international airspace, everyone gets to use them, and that there is global commerce. That won't be the case if China starts closing off large bodies of water, because other countries will do the same. We're going to head to a very different world, Frank. So everything is at stake.
You know, we've talked in the past with Kevin Freeman and spoke with him earlier in the program today a little bit about the pressure on the dollar as the reserve currency of the world, on which really I think our economy now vitally depends, given what we've done to essentially mortgage our future to our ability to print more money with impunity. What we're talking about here, Gordon, is the possibility that if countries around the world, as Kevin likes to say, cease to think that we are going to defend them, that's another powerful incentive to make an adjustment that many of them are tempted to make anyway, getting out of dollars that are increasingly less and less valuable. This is a problem that I believe bears the most urgent of attention for all of the reasons we've discussed, and we appreciate so much your helping illuminate what's at stake. Let me ask you quickly in closing, Gordon, about one other thing that you've written about at Newsweek, about the role that the Chinese are now playing in the drug offensive, really. It's not just a war. It's an offensive against our country out of Mexico and the cartels there. Talk about what Chinese money changers, money launderers are up to, and why that's so important for us as well.
Well, Chinese gangs are taking over the international money laundering. So, for instance, there was a gang based in Guadalajara that was money laundering for the Sinaloa cartel and for other Mexican drug groups. Basically, what this has done is with the certainly with the knowledge and probably with the consent of Beijing, because these Chinese gangs use Chinese financial apps and burner phones to move money through the Chinese financial system. The United States has asked for cooperation from Beijing on this, for instance, this Guadalajara-based Chinese gang, and Beijing has refused all help. So it's really an issue where we're seeing Chinese gangs, not only in Mexico and Latin America, but elsewhere, take over money laundering businesses with Beijing's assistance.
Yeah, making them more efficient and more effective in getting their product into our country to our great detriment, which I guess can be said of fentanyl as well, another area where the Chinese are not cooperating. Gordon Chang, thank you for helping us understand and really calibrate the challenge that we're facing from the Chinese Communist Party each week. We appreciate it so much and look forward to our visit with you again next week. In the meantime, stay well, my friend, and keep up the great work that you do. Victoria Coates joins us next. We'll talk a bit about the Middle East, including what's happening in the great state of Israel at the moment and what it means for all of us. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say, joined by a former Deputy National Security Advisor to the President of the United States, Donald Trump. Her name is Victoria Coates. She's also served as a National Security Advisor to Senator Ted Cruz and is these days a Senior Fellow of the Center for Security Policy, for which we're very grateful. Victoria, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Frank.
You and David Wormser participated in a very important webinar last week, moderated by our president at the Center for Security Policy, Fred Flights, on a subject that I know is very much top of mind for you and should be for all of us, namely the Iranian nuclear threat and how what the Biden administration is doing may be exacerbating it. Today, as it happens, there are new negotiations getting underway between the United States and Iran in Vienna. Talk a little bit about what is afoot there, and especially informed by the webinar, what are its prospects?
Well, the webinar was a great opportunity, you know, for me to explore, you know, where we are basically 70 days into the Biden administration, you know, with two people who know as much about the Iran deal as any, being Dave and Fred. And of course, Fred and I were both serving on the National Security Council staff together when President Trump made the decision to stop compliance with the JCPOA. And a lot of what we discussed was what went into that decision. And, you know, what we've seen in the 70 days of the Biden administration were at the beginning some reassuring words about getting a better deal, about consulting with regional allies. And then what we saw in terms of actions was just a race to get back into the deal. And, you know, Fred has a great piece about this in which he uses the phrase that the Iranians are now dictating to President Biden the terms of his own surrender. They took control of this process so quickly because the administration was so eager to reverse everything we had done, that they gave away 4 years of leverage that had been built up.
For absolutely nothing, I think, is the other point that you made in the conversation last week. And by the way, if people are interested in listening to that webinar, you can find it at securefreedom.org. It's one of a series of these very important products that the Center for Security Policy has been making available, and I particularly commend this one to you. It was a fascinating conversation. And Victoria, does there seem to be any prospect that this will actually redound to the benefit of our interests, or for that matter, those of our regional allies, given how the Biden administration has been proceeding at the moment and the clear emboldening of the Iranians that has accompanied it?
Unfortunately, no. I mean, the strategy to start with kind of preemptive concessions, starting with taking the Houthi off the FTO list, as we've discussed, has just been an almost...
That's a foreign terrorist organization.
Yes, I apologize for all the acrid speak. But the taking them off the foreign terrorist organization list, you know, was supposed to be a symbolic return to diplomacy after our cowboy tactics. And of course, the Houthi have just accelerated their terrorist behavior. And the State Department has had to put out statement after statement about this. It's just they're divorced from reality. And sadly, you know, they're presenting this situation as a choice between, you know, war or the JCPOA. Those are our two choices. And, you know, so they are in their minds wisely choosing the JCPOA. I mean, I would say there's a whole host of options in between those two things, but that's the way they're structuring it.
Witness what the Trump administration did with your help for 4 years. And again, the JCPOA deacronymized is the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the formal title of this so-called nuclear deal with Iran. And I guess what we're really confronting now, especially as we watch the Chinese forging a new strategic alliance with Iran that will further undermine whatever sanctions are going to be left when this process is done, and further embolden the Iranians, is the prospect that the mullahs will be racing forward with their nuclear weapons program and almost certainly have something to show for it in the very near future, don't you think?
Well, I think you're absolutely right in that every penny that Iran gets from the China deal will be put towards its military, primarily its nuclear program. And that's a message we need to get to the Iranian people loud and clear. I think they understand that. They didn't see any of the benefits. And this was interesting. Rob Malley, the current envoy for Iran, who's in Vienna leading these talks for the United States, said yesterday that he thought that Iran should enjoy the benefits. That's the quote. Enjoy the benefits of sanctions relief. Of course, that all goes to Tehran. It goes to the mullahs, to their slush funds, and to their
Swiss
nuclear
bank
program.
Accounts. Yeah. And not least, this nuclear weapons program. And Victoria, and I know this is difficult to say with certitude, but there are some who believe that the Iranians may already have at least one nuclear weapon, if not that they may be a matter of, well, maybe weeks, if not days, certainly months away from having that capacity at any moment. What is your current best guess as to where they are with respect to realizing these ambitions they've pursued relentlessly for decades?
My feeling is that once we saw the nuclear archive revealed by the Israelis in 2018, that they had the intent. And that, for me, is the critical thing. They want a nuclear weapon. And once you want a nuclear weapon, whether or not you develop the domestic capacity to produce and deliver one, you can always go shopping. I mean, we've certainly seen that from Pakistan to North Korea. These things are on offer. So if they made the strategic decision that they wanted one, as you said, in a matter of weeks, whether they can produce it themselves almost doesn't matter anymore. Once they've made the decision, they have the intent, they can get their hands on one. You know, how effective it's going to be, how precise it would be, you know, those are other questions, but their ability to get one, particularly if they have the cash, you know, is no longer in question.
And obviously this has profound implications for most especially the region, I would argue for us as well, but for our friends in Israel, our friends across the Persian Gulf, in the Arab states. And unfortunately, as you know so well, Victoria Coates, as a serious student of these matters, as well as a now longtime practitioner in the national security arena, nature and geopolitics abhor vacuums. Is the perception that the United States is no longer checking what the Iranians are up to, and perhaps even now going to be complicit in the mullah's pursuit of these nuclear capabilities, likely to compel others in the region, either jointly or severally, as they say, individually, to act to try to prevent that from happening?
Well, I think so. And unfortunately, the new administration has written down their interest in decoupling from the Middle East. And then they've taken practical steps, pulling things, especially Patriot batteries, out of Saudi Arabia, for example, last month, just after the Saudis had asked for more help in their missile defenses, having endured some 80 attacks out of Yemen since the beginning of the new administration.
From those Houthi rebels that the administration at the outset, as you said, sought to rehabilitate.
That aren't terrorists. So I think we will see that. If there's a silver lining to any of this, we are seeing Israel draw ever closer to our traditional Gulf partners and allies, you know, particularly Saudi Arabia and UAE. You know, that's certainly those are certainly relationships we should want to foster and encourage. And, you know, hopefully that can happen organically, because I really don't see this administration spending much time or energy on it.
Yeah. Victoria, we have talked elsewhere in the program with some of our colleagues about China and the threat that it is now posing to Taiwan and what it is doing in the South China Sea that is a threat to all of our allies as well as our vital interests. And now you've added to this mix Iran and what is possibly going to eventuate in terms of a conflict there. It does seem as though we are at the cusp of avoidable, needless wars that could be very difficult to confine to the region most immediately involved, the regions most immediately involved. And I wonder whether we're going to look back on this election and the course of policy action that has been taken in its aftermath as the event that ushered in a disastrous time for our country and people. And it will be grist for our mill, needless to say, and we'll look forward to visiting with you about it all. But it is very, very unhappy, and I think perhaps downright tragic, and we'll pray that we are spared the consequences of the sorts of mistakes that you've been chronicling. But thank you for doing it here, and I hope you'll come back to us again next week to do more of it. I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.